I'm told the Undertaker, Undertaker, please drive slow, for the body we are hauling, Lord, I hate to see her go.
This is Tanya Marsh, and you're listening to Death at Sec. On today's episode, I'm joined by two third-year law students at the Wake Forest University School of Law, Jonah Bamel and Greg Volk. Jonah and Greg were both in my property class 2 years ago, and this semester they're in my decedent's estates and trust class. A couple of weeks ago, we covered the topic that we're going to discuss today. I appreciated their thoughtful insights in class and asked them if they'd be willing to share them on the podcast. I'm so grateful to both of them for saying yes. On today's episode, Jonah, Greg, and I are going to discuss planning for incapacity as part of estate planning. Most of us think of estate planning as solely determining what will happen to our property after we die, but comprehensive estate planning is actually more complicated than that and involves some planning for the period prior to death, when because of failing health or a sudden accident, we may experience one or more periods of incapacity. Planning for that period means thinking about who will be empowered to make healthcare decisions for us, if we want to predetermine end-of-life decisions, and who will be empowered to make financial decisions for us and to control our property if we are unable to do so. Planning for incapacity typically involves using all or some of three types of documents. First, a healthcare proxy or healthcare power of attorney. Second, a living will or advance directive. And finally, a durable power of attorney. On this episode, Jonah, Greg, and I will discuss these three types of documents and some things that you should keep in mind during your own planning. Jonah and Greg, thank you so much for joining me today on Death at Sec. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to be here.
So we're going to talk about planning for incapacity in estate planning. And you guys are both in Decedents, Estates, and Trusts this semester. And so we started out the semester, and I ask you, do you have a will and these sorts of ancillary documents? And what was your answer? Do you have one?
No.
Okay. And then I asked, do you think you should have one? Even before the class started, even before I made my case for why you maybe should. And what did you say?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. So I have to ask you two, who are both mature adults, been in law school for 2.5 years.
Well, adults.
Relatively speaking, mature adults.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah. So if you know you need these things, why do you not have them?
I think some of it is, I think there's a lot of people that find this whole idea to just be something they don't want to touch, whether it's
this whole idea of planning?
I think it's fairly morbid to think about incapacity or living will or death. And I think some of it is people are afraid or scared or sort of, I don't want to touch that. I'm not ready for that. Or it's too early to think about that. Or I think there's just a sort of like ickiness around it. Like it just, the thought makes someone uncomfortable and it's just easier to not do that. But I think it makes everything in those terrible circumstances so much better for yourself, hopefully, but also for the people that you love who are going to be the ones actually relying on these documents. Mm-hmm. If you have one of these or all of these set up and you have the voice that you might not have at that time.
Mm-hmm. Jonah, how old are you?
I am 32.
Greg, how old are you?
38.
See what I said? Mature adults. And and we...
Physically.
And so we talked about two cases in class, right? We talked about the Nancy Cruzan case, which sort of led to a lot of changes in the law about living wills, advance directives. And we talked about the Schiavo case. And in both of those cases, Terry Schiavo and Nancy Cruzan were younger than both of you are, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did that... Try not to give you a hard time, Jonah, but you're saying that you recognize all these things sort of in the third person, but that was 3 weeks ago we had this conversation, and have you created these documents in the past 3 weeks?
Well, the easy thing to say is no, because I'm a law student and I don't have time. But I mean...
I knew I should have assigned it.
that's a good idea. Yeah, make all your students have these.
Yeah, I mean,
I should. I absolutely should. I think only reading these cases, and I mean, I remember, and I'm sure Greg does too, the Terry Schiavo situation. I remember the story being on the nightly news, and just like it felt so morbid to me to like be peering into this story.
Yeah.
And as an outsider, look, I was living up in Massachusetts, they're down in Florida, and the terrible tragedy of what's been happening to that family for 10 years is on the news. Mm-hmm. It just seemed like so terrible to have that publicized, and it's publicized because, I mean, there's a lot of other reasons that the story was being publicized, but the root cause of it, arguably, is they didn't know what she would have wanted, and they had different understandings of it, and it could have been, and hopefully for anybody in that situation, or who could be in that situation, it could be cleared up by laying out what you would want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right, because there's something particularly tragic about it that they... You know, her parents and her husband both were convinced they knew what she wanted. And the only way you can possibly adjudicate that disagreement is in court and making your private family business, they're not all obviously going to end up on the national news, but it's still, you're taking it outside the realm of the family, right? So what I hear you saying, and then I'm going to interrogate Greg a little bit, but what I hear you saying is, even though you intellectually know that this is a good thing to do, and you both knew that even before the class started, there are still barriers, right? Even if you can sort of objectively say these are the barriers, mortality, seems creepy, all this kind of stuff, it's hard to overcome them.
Yeah, I think there's both the psychological ones of, you know, like I was saying, creepy or morbid, but there's also, I think, practical ones of, even before going through that class, sitting there going, I think it's a good idea. I don't know where I would start. I don't know what I would do to get one. I don't know where to go or who to talk to about it. It's just sort of on my to-do list for life to figure that out.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to explain these things to people who are listening to the podcast and make it a little easier for them. So what's your story, Greg? Why don't you have these documents yet?
So
everybody listening to this right now is like, you invited these guys on, you're just ambushing them, yeah. Making them feel bad. Sorry.
Our class participation grade is going down. So the for Will, we had this conversation 2 years ago, and you suggested...
when you were in property?
Yeah, I'll mention the term, but I'm not going to say that's what it was, upbraided me. You pointed me to some resources in the library, and you're like, oh, it's great, you know, just pull this book, and you can look through it, and you'll be able to write your own, and it'll be fine. And I went so far as to pull the book, and I immediately got so overwhelmed, and it was like, one of my fears is screwing it up, like... And I don't know if it's a rational fear, but if you do it wrong, maybe it's just as bad or worse than having nothing. But there's the property issue, which is not really a big deal to me. I'm married, my wife and I have a son. Most of it is all jointly held, and you know, the law operates in the background and cleans up some of that stuff. But is concerned for my son. And I didn't realize before we talked about it in this class, the decedent's trust and estates, that one of the things I wanted to do in my will is express whose desire for guardianship, my desires for that and my wife's. And now I've come to find out that it's not even binding. We don't get to pick that. A court gets to pick that. Ultimately.
So until I said it, you didn't realize children aren't property? I thought we covered that 2 years ago, man.
I'm still suspect. I'm going to dig in on that one myself. I guess that is probably one of the biggest things holding me up, because I feel like I want to have conversations with family members that I haven't had. And yes, to play the easy excuse, law school has a way of depressing every other priority other than like the task at hand. And it's not okay, but I just haven't made the time for it.
Well, I think you guys have both articulated a lot of the reasons that people don't think about doing this. There's sort of an all or nothing, right? Fear that if I and also the fear of getting it wrong. So, and to even get to the place where you think you can do it right and do it all, you have to think about it and you have to talk to other people. And those are uncomfortable conversations even just to have with a spouse and close family members, right?
I think there are uncomfortable conversations to have with yourself sometimes too.
Yeah.
To actually think, like, to put yourself in a terrible hypothetical and then try to figure out what I would want. It's a lot easier to just not.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of times when I ask the class the question, do you have these documents? Do you think you need them? And especially when you're just talking about a will, most law students will say, well, I don't have any property anyway, and I'll be dead. I don't care, right? Like it's somebody else's problem. Maybe your perspective changes when you have a spouse, and especially when you have a child, right? And you think, well, yeah, it's somebody else's problem, but I care about the person whose problem it would be, and I don't want to leave them with this enormous problem in addition to my loss.
Yeah, or
for the record, they're both nodding. They're not used to this whole podcast
sorry,
yet.
Yeah. And if you think about the poor Shiva situation, that was also her parents were involved. And if you're young enough and you have parents or you have any family, it doesn't even have to be spouse, but those medical decision making, the healthcare proxies, those can be important regardless of property. Those are decisions that someone in your loved life is going to, those are decisions that someone in your experience that you love or that loves you is going to be in charge of that. And, and giving them the guidance is the important thing.
Right.
Yeah. I think, and we've sort of hit on all of this, but there are two reasons to do this kind of planning. One is to see that your wishes are carried out, but the second is to lighten the burden you might place on your family members.
Yeah.
And those two might intertwine.
Yeah.
And I think that I think there's probably a little bit of a generational divide in our class. Joan and I are on the older side, but I think some people you see, like, I think one student I categorized taking care of this stuff as mom's job. And it's like, well,
yeah,
maybe it's time for it to be, at some point in time, it becomes your job to relieve mom of that, or dad, or brother, or sister, or spouse, or partner, you know, whomever.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if that's a generational thing or that's a single person thing,
yeah.
Right? Mm. I mean, because maybe something shifts in you when you get married or get in a committed, you know, long-term relationship, even if you're not married, that you stop being part of the nuclear family, you know, that's not your primary. And as long as we still have parents around, I think you're never too old to want your parents to take care of everything. Make it all better.
One of these days they'll start, I'm hoping.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. I love you, Mom and Dad.
All right. So let's talk about the three different kind of documents that would be involved in this sort of planning for incapacity. But we mentioned the Shivo case and the Cruzan case. So they're, I don't want to get into the cases, but they're important because they articulate sort of the legal principle or doctrine that we start with, right? So, for example, in the Shivo case, some people, I think, are surprised that it's a battle between the husband and the parents, right? So what is the general sort of point of law of the Cruzan case and the Shivo case in terms of who gets to make these end-of-life decisions? Who gets to make end-of-life decisions? I didn't tell them I was going to call on them. So now they're looking at me.
It's cold calling.
It's cold calling 2 weeks after we did it in class.
Well, the citizen, the decedent does, if they have demonstrated to a court to a court satisfaction of clear and convincing evidence. Is that correct? Yeah. Basically, if it's unclear what you wanted, then you don't necessarily get what you want because they don't even know what it is. But
right. So in the Cruzan case, the question was really, do we have a fundamental right to make end of life decisions for ourselves? And the answer is, right, as long as we have capacity, as long as we're competent, we have rights to make decisions about our own healthcare, and that includes withholding of treatment. So if we are competent and have capacity and can communicate, we can tell the doctors, don't resuscitate me, don't put me on a ventilator, right, don't, et cetera,
right.
Take me off the ventilator, if we have capacity. So the question is, in a case like the Cruzan case where her brain was deprived of oxygen, same with the Shivo case, they lacked capacity legally. They couldn't communicate. But while they were competent, they didn't leave any instructions. So then it's not that the right to make decisions about them transferred to the other family members. It was, in both of those cases, it was about what was their desire and did they express it to anybody in a way that, as you said, Greg, the court's looking for clear and convincing evidence of what they wanted, right? So we're not substituting decision-making of other people unless that's what the person who is suffering from the incapacity wanted. Is that sound reasonable? Okay. So then these documents that we're going to talk about are a way for people who are now, who are incapacitated at some point in the future, to record their wishes when they still have capacity. Okay.
Yeah.
So the first kind is the healthcare proxy or the healthcare power of attorney. So would one of you guys talk about what that is? Sort of generally, what do those documents, what kind of decisions can we make in those documents?
So the healthcare proxy, or the durable power of attorney, that is where I, being of sound mind, I am a person, if I'm signing one of those documents, I am giving someone whom I love and trust, hopefully, but someone who I'm naming in that document to be my agent, to be my proxy, and who I am empowering to make those life decisions for me, in those moments where, even if I've, you know, made other evidence known previously, sometimes depending on the terms of the proxy, I can basically say to Greg, whom I love and trust, Greg,
oh, that's so sweet.
We're doing these documents right now. Actually.
Yeah. Well, that's why we're here, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
This counts. This is our clear and convincing evidence.
This was this a podcast. That's a good point, actually.
Yeah, this podcast will be submitted in court in some terrible alternate future, hopefully. No, but if I can be the person signing this document or stating this, recording this podcast, I'm giving to Greg the authority to make those decisions in the healthcare field on my behalf.
Mm-hmm.
I am saying, step into my shoes and be my voice, because there may be decisions that I cannot make, and I am authorizing you to make them for me.
Okay. So one of the first things that happens in these documents is you have to indicate at what point they become active, right? What triggers them. And so we looked in class at forms from a couple of different states. We looked at North Carolina and maybe Alabama. Do we look at the healthcare form in Alabama? No, Florida. It was Florida.
Yeah.
And there are sort of different conditions that triggered, right, in each of those.
So at the beginning of these forms, it sets up when the form takes effect, when it kicks in.
Okay. Do you have one in front of you,
yes.
Greg? Which one do you have?
Yeah, I have North Carolina.
So when does the North Carolina one become effective?
So the North Carolina one becomes effective in terms of the powers that can be executed under it when one of the physicians that you can list, when a physician listed below determines that you lack capacity to make or communicate healthcare decisions relating to your care, and continues as long as you're incapacitated until your death.
Okay. So basically through this document, I can appoint an agent, and I can actually appoint more than one person or designate an order of them. I think on the statutory form in North Carolina, there's room for three different names. And then I can also limit their authority. There's a whole section here about special limitations, right? So in other words, we're not sort of stuck in a cookie cutter of the forms assuming we're all going to make the same decisions and we want our agents to have the same authority, right? We can tailor the authority that we're giving.
So the form sets out in that part we just discussed, like a broad grant of power to the agent is specified. And then it gives you sort of like a malleable form by checking boxes, by initialing boxes, ways to limit what they can do.
Yeah. And, so let's talk about the broad power. So, for example, requesting, reviewing, receiving any information, verbal or written, regarding my physical or mental health, including but not limited to medical and hospital records, to consent to the disclosure of this information. So that's important, right? You can go ask questions. You can employ or discharge healthcare providers. You can consent to admission to and discharge from a hospital or any other sort of healthcare facility. And then really, the sort of controversial parts involve subsection G, authorizing the withholding or withdrawal of life prolonging measures, right? So that's where some of these special provisions might come in that impact that grant of general power.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like the first limitation you could put on is that the agent cannot have the decision to withhold artificial nutrition or hydration or those sorts of things. So you would, if you give them your power of attorney, healthcare power of attorney, they can help with the doctor decide treatment, make treatment decisions, but one of those decisions cannot be the denial of nutrition.
Okay.
If you pick that on the form.
Right.
Yeah, and the forms also provide the opportunity for refusing treatment that is inconsistent with religious belief, or there's sort of open-ended opportunities in the North Carolina forms for you to insert limitations of your own choosing if you have specific ones that would be tailored to your needs, wants, and desires.
So we keep talking about the North Carolina form. Where does this North Carolina form come from?
It's based in the statute for North Carolina's healthcare power of attorneys, but in a practical sense, my best guess is that it comes from a lawyer. I mean, North Carolina has website, and wherever you are in the country or in the world, hopefully you're governing jurisdiction has these forms available to you that you can find, and I think you said that we would link to some authority or some resources.
Yeah, in the show notes, I'll put some links. There's a website North Carolina Secretary of State has with the forms for all the documents we're going to talk about today on their website, but I'll put some other general sort of national forms up there too. And at the near the end of the episode, we can talk about sort of next steps and what people should do. But right, so the Cruzan decision was a decision by the United States Supreme Court and established for everybody in the country that we have a right to make medical decisions, and that if we leave clear and convincing evidence of our wishes and desires in that regard, that those that evidence is binding even during a period of incapacity. So then the states, after that decision, went and created statutes that tell people how to effectuate and create that clear and convincing evidence in each particular state. So most nearly every state, if not every state, has these sort of statutory forms that you can find. That at least gives you a starting place. But as I think we talked about in class, you're not bound to them if you don't think that they cover everything or discuss things or set the standards in the way that you really want to. But it's dangerous for non-lawyers to sort of go messing around with and trying to change these very legal documents, because we may not fully appreciate the changes that we're making, right? So it would be better to talk to a lawyer about them. But at least the statutory forms give us a starting place for thinking about what our options are. And if we're comfortable with the way that they're written, they're just fill in the blank, check the box, and then you're done.
Yeah, you at least have some clear and convincing evidence,
right,
in the unfortunate event that ever any of this is needed.
Right. Did you talk to your parents about healthcare powers of attorney, or you talked to them about living wills?
I talked to them about both.
Okay. Do you want to? Are you at liberty to share any of that?
Sure. Yes. So my parents have living wills, and they had healthcare power of attorney, but they had not touched them in 30 years, probably.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of an interesting exercise to them. I told them I was doing this podcast, and they went and dug up their forms, and they did not cover. They looked at these forms, the statutory ones from North Carolina, and then compared them to what they had. And they were like, "Oh, wait a minute, we didn't address many things, many issues raised by the statutory forms that we wished we had." One of the issues that they touched on, I think you just sort of hinted at, which is the need for an attorney, is that not all of this is clear, not all of it's defined. So, for instance, in the healthcare power of attorney form, they talk about life prolonging measures,
right?
But that's not defined. So, I mean, you can sort of control the levers of nutrition or hydration, but beyond that, that's as specific as you get with life prolonging measures. So things like that, I think would be. It'd behoove you to have an attorney, to meet with an attorney and talk about that. And the other thing is how, I don't want to jump the gun, but how this form interacts with a living will,
right,
because they might conflict, and you might want them to conflict, and which one trumps the other. But yeah, I think that it made them think in the North Carolina form, the default is the attending physician. That when that attending physician, it kicks in when that person makes the call, you lack capacity. It's like, okay, well, who is the attending physician? Is it a resident? You know,
yeah, somebody in the emergency room or your long term care provider?
Yeah,
yeah.
And the form gives you the opportunity to specify your personal physician, but if you don't do that, then that's sort of an open question.
Mm-hmm. And so, was that an uncomfortable conversation to have with your parents?
Not really. They are pretty forthright with this stuff, and I would say I try. We're going to have them regardless, these conversations. And if anything, I try to kind of get out of them because maybe it's too much.
So it's uncomfortable for you.
Yeah, yes. Well, yeah. So there's a saying in our family is that, what I would talk to mom the other day. Oh, man, did she go hospice on you? And so what going hospice means is she, her mother went through hospice. They had a lot of trouble getting her into it, partly because of troubles with documentation and who could make the call when. Mm-hmm. But she had my mom had a great experience with my grandmother's end of life, and was moved to volunteer with hospice, and now she is very much, she's a volunteer. She goes and gives talks about the need to have these conversations. So I guess it hasn't been effective, and I don't have these forms in place, but it's definitely been effective in that it's on my radar and probably on her neighbor's radar, you know, probably on the grocery checkout person's radar. So, yeah, she leans into these conversations hard.
Hi, Greg's mom. Keep up the good work.
I think it's interesting, though, that you for all how forthright and how hospice they are, they still hadn't touched it in 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, she said that it was a goal this year to separate from my talk about this podcast to revisit it. But yeah, I mean, definitely. Maybe you should make this like, every couple of years, put it on your calendar or something like that.
Yeah, have a physical, have a dentist appointment, check your powers of attorney.
Yeah, that's all the fun stuff. Just have like a Tuesday in January where you get it all out of the way.
Might as well do it when you're doing your taxes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Get all the unpleasantness out of the way at the same time. Okay, well, did you have anything else you want to talk about the healthcare power of attorney?
No, I think the only other thing is really to underscore how flexible they mm-hmm. can be. The statutes set out sort of minimum requirements. There might be, a requirement that it's notarized or that it's been witnessed by people, which goes towards the clear and convincing evidence that would be required for a court. But you can, the North Carolina one literally has fill in the blank lines where you can fill in any limitations you want. And going to an attorney, if you wanted to do something that is not included in the form, an attorney might be able to draft something that still meets the requirements of the statute, but conforms with your wishes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the flexibility of these forms is something that also would make it less daunting to sort of, I don't have to fit myself into one of the boxes. That's all right. It doesn't have to be yes, this, no, this. It can, you can really tailor it as specifically as you want.
Yeah. And it may be an easier entry place for people to just take a fill in the blank, check the box form. And then, when you're annually revisiting the question, you may get more comfortable with it, and then you'd be okay with essentially starting with a blank piece of paper, right? And then or just editing it and really sort of tailoring it. But it's also good to look at these statutory forms because, for example, the North Carolina one, and I think we looked at a couple others that are fairly consistent with that, they want two witnesses and a notary. So I hear a lot of non-lawyers give advice, very well-meaning advice from time to time. Well, if you want people to be informed of your wishes, just write it down. Well, it's not enough to write it down, right? Because if the statutory form has a place for two witnesses and a notary, a court, in trying to evaluate whether or not you have sufficient evidence that this is somebody's wishes, they're going to want two witnesses and a notary. And maybe your lawyer can talk them out of that, but why set yourself up for an uphill battle? Right? If you want a hospital to be able to rely on it or hospice or, anybody to rely on it with sort of without questioning it, then have all the formalities that are sort of recognized by law and you're not saving anybody time and emotional turmoil if you set them up with a document that doesn't meet the requirements right away.
Yeah.
And there's also, as we talked about in class, sort of a balance struck between the formalities that you require, your state requires, because the more witnesses and requiring witnesses and requiring notarization, there's safeguards to make sure that your wishes are expressed formally, but also there are impediments to executing these documents like quickly.
Yeah.
So if you're in a state like that, you want to make sure it's another reason to get it done ahead of time.
Yeah. And we talked about places that you can go find a notary, right? Now, I mean, since we're all sort of, you guys will be lawyers soon. I think lawyer, knock on wood. We know where to find notaries, but I think it was also mentioned banks often have notaries. Mm-hmm. Sometimes libraries have notaries, right? Mm-hmm. You can Google it.
FedEx or UPS?
Oh, yeah,
I know.
FedEx.
I got mine done. I had to notarize my bar application.
Okay, cool. So when in doubt, get two disinterested witnesses. You don't want to have the person you're appointing as your healthcare power of attorney being a witness. You want two other witnesses.
And sign it first.
Yeah. Sign it in front of the notary. That's right. Okay, good. Yeah, look, we're being so useful with all these signature formalities. Okay, let's talk about living wills. So how are living wills, and in North Carolina, the statutory document is called My Desire for a Natural Death, which I find fascinating. But most places they're called advanced directives or living wills. So how are those different from healthcare power of attorneys, and should somebody have both?
So the advanced directives are specific controls on what sort of treatment you're going to have. They also kick in when you become incapacitated and certain conditions are met based on the form, or if you're using a form, or how your advanced directive is laid out. I think ideally you want both, because there may be situations you hadn't thought about in your advanced directives with an attorney or without. But if you have delegated powers that can sort of to a healthcare proxy, you can step in and say, oh no, this is what mom or dad or, you know, would have wanted in this case. And then they have the ability to sort of trump it. But yeah, this is sort of like a specifically tailored narrow form to pick what treatments you do or don't want. In what conditions?
Right. So unlike the healthcare power of attorney, which is empowering another person to make decisions on your behalf when you have incapacity, a living will or desire for a natural death form is giving instructions about what choices you want made, right? So it's not about empowering another person to make decisions on your behalf that can be situational and contextual and whatever. It's saying, so for example, I'm looking at the Florida form. You could initial the box that says, I declare that if I'm incapacitated, and here are your three choices, which you could initial all or one of these or two of these. I have a terminal condition. I have an end stage condition, which, as we discussed in class, I'm not quite sure what the difference is between terminal and end stage, but because life is a terminal condition. Or third, I'm in a persistent vegetative state. So the Florida form says if you're incapacitated and you check one or more of those boxes, then you are directing that life prolonging procedures be withheld or withdrawn. It's a shall, right?
Yeah.
It's not a may, it's a shall. North Carolina form is a may, or you can initial shall, but you get to choose on the North Carolina form, may or shall. And I think, as we were talking about earlier, Jonah, that we're not, just because the Florida form is a shall and North Carolina is a may or shall, it doesn't mean you don't have a choice between may or shall in Florida, right? It just means that's the choice the legislature made, and that's the easiest choice. But if you're uncomfortable with that, you can change and tweak the form to something that makes more sense for you. And then the choices for when this would kick in North Carolina are pretty different.
Yeah, so the North Carolina conditions, one, again, initialing when you want the directives to apply. The North Carolina one is, I have an incurable or irreversible condition that will result in my death within a relatively short period of time. Or, I have become unconscious and my healthcare providers determine that to a high degree of medical certainty, I will never regain my consciousness, which sounds to me like the persistent vegetative state.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I suffer from advanced dementia or any other condition which results in the substantial loss of my cognitive ability, and my healthcare providers determine that to a high degree of medical certainty. This loss is not reversible, which opens up a different avenue of this kicking in that the Florida form did not have.
Right.
And then again, each of these, they have the initial of may withhold or withdraw life prolonging measures or shall withhold or withdraw life prolonging measures. And it applies only to the ones that you have initialed. So you can, for example, with both of these forms, you can pick one or two of these in which it will kick in, but not another. Or you can pick all of them, or I suppose picking none of them would defeat the purpose of having it. But
yes, you're not going to pick any of them. Don't bother.
Yeah, no, but it's the difference with the healthcare proxy is appointing someone, and in this one, it's literally you speaking for yourself.
Exactly.
In a time when you can't.
Exactly.
And it's not entirely on point, but it actually was kind of fortuitous. I saw that earlier this weekend there was a headline in The Onion that was, what grandma would have wanted keeps changing during funeral planning. And I think of, obviously, funeral planning is different in many respects than end-of-life care. But in terms of the what grandma would have wanted, I think these forms put an end to that. They put that to bed. And if there is any chance of a shifting memory, or even if the healthcare proxy is, if you're, you know, they may not have accurately made the opinion or decision that you would have wanted, mm-hmm. the healthcare proxy is you're telling someone, make a choice for me.
Mm-hmm.
This form, the living will, is I am making my choice for the unknown future. And if that future happens, my choice is made.
Mm-hmm. And on the episode of the podcast, when I talked to Rebecca Morrow about doing funeral planning as part of estate planning, that's one of the things that we were talking about, is being able to take those decisions off somebody else's plate is a loving thing, right?
Yes.
So that they don't have to agonize about, you know, or the whole Onion story, right? Different siblings or whatever are expressing their other conflicts with one another through this as the
Suddenly your healthcare proxy becomes a proxy argument for them to settle things.
Exactly.
And it's so true what you were just saying about the episode with Professor Morrow. It's an act of love to take this off of the shoulders of someone that loves you. It is one of the best gifts you can give to a loved one, is your expressed desires, so that they don't have to rack themselves with guilt or anxiety or doubt about making the decision.
Mm-hmm.
Because these decisions, if you're in the unfortunate situation of having a loved one for whom you now are the person making those decisions, and you don't have these guidance, it is a thing that you will lose sleep over for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
If you are worried that you didn't make the decision that either was right or that they would have wanted. And this is the best night's sleep that you can give to the loved one who will ultimately make those decisions. It's really important.
It should be called My Desire for You to Have Peace of Mind in Perpetuity.
Yeah.
There you go.
We'll write the legislature.
Yeah.
So, Greg, you were talking about the interaction, at least in North Carolina, and this is true, I think, in other states too, of the healthcare power of attorney form with this living will advanced directive My Desire form, right? So can you talk a little bit about the interaction of these forms?
Yes. By the way, we're just talking about that term comes from the North Carolina form, which is just beautifully labeled My Desire for Natural Death, which I just love. It's sort of like Rococo and prosaic at the exact same time. It's like set in the first person. It's amazing.
There should be more laws in the first person.
Yeah.
Kudos, North Carolina General Assembly.
My parents, like I was saying, they had versions of both these documents, and the statutory forms covered things that they didn't think about. They wanted, one question was, nutrition? Like, doesn't nutrition include hydration? Like, you know, just sort of practically, like, what nutrition does, like, is it somehow, like, I don't know, I don't mean to be glib, but literally they were like, what, you know, how is nutrition given where it doesn't include where it includes no hydration?
Yeah.
So it raised practical questions like that.
Well, and, you know, as we were discussing in class when we were looking at these forms initially, there wasn't a person with a medical degree in that room, yeah. right? And so a bunch of people who are going to be lawyers and one who already is trying to figure out what some of these medical terms means. I mean, there's, yeah, we yeah. all have a lot to learn about.
Yeah. So my mom, I think now is going to have a, I think she's going to have a long meeting with some doctor and oh, have a list of questions. But yeah, so I mean, I guess maybe the best way to put it is a sort of a hypothetical that my dad raised based on these forms is that they have a advanced directive that says withhold hydration, or excuse me, withhold nutrition.
But not hydration.
Yeah. So withhold nutrition, if you withhold nutrition, my dad in this scenario will pass away within 3 days. Well, my sister's out of the country and right. she wants to come back and say bye physically to my father. Okay, what do you do there? Well, if you have a healthcare power of attorney that, and you've executed them properly, then if I am that, you know, the person, the attorney in fact who has those powers, then I can say to the doctor, no, we know the form says withhold nutrition, but give it to him for 3 days until she can come back.
Yep.
And that sort of, like, I think that was a big takeaway of, like, oh, there can be scenarios where, though you wanted these, the advanced directive expresses your wishes, but there may be scenarios where you hadn't thought about or you want to sort of deviate from that.
Yeah, that's an excellent point because, like, the Florida form, you check the box, so I'm incapacitated and I have an end-stage condition. And then it says shall. So, you know, snap, immediately, it's instructing everybody to withhold those measures. And that may not be sort of in the context of the situation the right thing to do. The right thing to do may be to wait some period of time. And so you can either write that kind of thing in, right? Like, you shall do this after everybody who said they want to be there has had a chance to say goodbye. I mean, you could just write that in the form. Mm-hmm. Or by making somebody your agent in the healthcare power of attorney, you could allow that to happen sort of if the situation arises. And it's an excellent point. This is part of the problem about making our wishes known in a blanket way when we don't know what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah.
And we may not want the same outcome, you know, sort of regardless of the circumstances under which it happens. And especially if you have a form and you don't look at it for 30 years, right? I'm sure the things that they were thinking about 30 years ago when you were 8 years old are different than the things that they think about now.
For sure.
Yeah.
Not to mention different changes in what's possible medically.
Right.
You know, there might be advances in some technology or whatnot, and it's important to keep all that up to date.
Well, and also, I should say, we're talking about this, I mean, and it's in part because, like, the North Carolina form is labeled my desire for natural death. Some people have no desire for natural death. They want everything, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you have that right, too. And if that's what you want, then you need to put that in writing in the same sort of way. I mean, we're sort of defaulting towards people saying they want to limit life-prolonging measures because the default is going to be assuming that you do want to be saved. But I guess if you're worried that somebody's going to pull the plug on you, put it in writing that you don't want that to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, definitely. If that is a worry, then I would say yes, write that down.
Yeah. And have two witnesses and a notary.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. So then the last document is really, and we can just talk about this briefly, but a lot of people do this in the context of estate planning too, is a durable power of attorney, which really has nothing to do with healthcare. But I think sometimes people get confused because they say, oh, I have a healthcare power of attorney. I don't need a durable power of attorney. So what's the difference between a regular power of attorney and the healthcare power of attorney that we're talking about?
So a regular power of attorney gives the and it's called an attorney in fact, right? The person who receives the power under
correct.
The okay.
In both cases, whenever you have a power of attorney.
So, if you are the delegee, if that's a word. the attorney in fact who gets the powers under the power of attorney, for a durable power of attorney, it can be every legal decision that's basically not healthcare.
So we're really talking about financial planning. Power over property, et cetera. But if a person's incapacitated, the only, it, it is not true that the only concern is, medical, right? It's
right.
The only concern is not healthcare decisions, because they have bank accounts and they have real estate and somebody has to pay the taxes and, you know, all that good stuff, right? Healthcare power attorney does nothing for that. So if a person is in a persistent vegetative state and they haven't signed a power of attorney authorizing somebody to make all those kinds of legal decisions for them, then we're really stuck in sort of limbo,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, and the durable part of the durable power of attorney just means that if a person becomes incapacitated, the power of attorney is not revoked, is not withdrawn. Durable, it survives the person's incapacitation so that the power of attorney continues and the attorney, in fact, can continue to make those decisions, because otherwise a power of attorney normally would extinguish if a person is incapacitated.
Right, because just in daily life, we might need them if, like, we need to, you know, buy or sell a house, but one of the people who needs to sign documents is out of the state or out of the country or something. Then the power of attorney can let an agent or an attorney, in fact, as you said, Greg, sign in their stead, right? But one important difference between sort of the healthcare power of attorney and the living will on the one hand and the durable power of attorney on the other is that that first group of documents, they don't kick in until a person becomes incapacitated. Whereas a durable power of attorney, unless you specifically write it that way, is effective immediately. So you want to be careful in terms of appointing people as your attorney in fact. Now, it may be, you know, you trust your spouse because your property is owned jointly and all that good stuff anyway, you just appoint each other power of attorney, or you could write into it that it doesn't kick in until a moment of incapacity, et cetera. But it has to be somebody you really trust, because they will have all kinds of authority to go in and make financial decisions with your assets.
I really should have trusted Greg more before I signed that.
Yeah, I've been making him fill out and sign documents while we talk.
Can I have that back?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to look it over real fast. And I already got it notarized, so we got that taken care of.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
All right, well, this is good. So then if people are listening and they've become convinced, I don't know if it undermines our ability to convince them that you guys haven't done these documents yourselves yet.
Yeah, I've been feeling like a hypocrite for about 20 minutes now.
Yeah.
I don't know what the running time is.
I didn't want to really call you out on that, but you're going to go home immediately and do this, right?
Hopefully we can...
You don't have class for the rest of the day.
Hopefully we can persuasively communicate our guilt and shame over this podcast.
No, I know. You're just hoping this podcast is clear and convincing evidence. Although neither of you said what you wanted to have happen in your own cases, so I don't think that really works.
Well, I desire for a supernatural death.
Okay, I don't even know what that means.
Neither do I. I just
you're going to be shot into space.
Yeah.
Cryogenics or something. All right, so if people are convinced, more so than you two have been, about the need to do these documents, so I'm going to put up some links, as Jonah said, up on the website so that you can look at some forms or sort of helpful pointers for information. But I think the three of us are on the same page about nothing substitutes talking to a lawyer, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, even if something isn't in the form and you want it to be, or something is in the form and you don't understand what it means, the attorney is the person that can help.
Or you're in law school and you're lazy. not lazy, but for some reason you haven't gotten it done.
Yeah.
I'm going to go. I did email one attorney, and now I'm going to dig up that email and reach out to them again.
All right. Good. And I will just say for everybody who says, well, I don't have an attorney and I don't really want to go hire an attorney because that sounds like an expensive thing. At Wake Forest this last weekend, we had a clinic on wills for first responders, right? And so did free estate planning for people on a walk-in basis. And a lot of law schools will have clinics where there's wills for specific groups of people or wills for just anybody who walks in and says, I need some sort of basic estate planning documents and can get documents like these. We also have an elder law clinic that helps out underserved populations with a whole range of documents, including these types of documents. So if you live near a law school, you might want to check and see if they have a clinic or they have special events like that where they'll do some estate planning for you for free or at a discounted rate. And then a lot of local bar associations also have special days or projects like this, right?
Yeah, maybe the legal aid in your area or the equivalent, the Maybe some attorney who's really generous with their pro bono will help you out if you're worried about the expense.
Yeah. So you could just call the local bar association or, you know, Google and look on the website of the local bar association, the state bar association, to see if there's any links to resources. And so, awesome. Well, thank you guys so much.
Thank
I
you
really
for having
appreciate
you
coming and rehashing our classroom discussion in a slightly more podcasty way.
Yeah, no, it's great. The one thing I wanted this afternoon was to be cold called and then upbraided.
Well, I'm glad I could meet all of your requirements.
No, it was a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
I don't want to die in the hospital. I don't want to die in the hospital. I don't want to die in the hospital. You got to take me back outside.
Thanks again to Jonah Bamel and Greg Volk for joining me today on Death at Sec to discuss planning for incapacity. If you're interested in learning more, please stop by the website www.deathatsec.com for the show notes and links to resources from the American Bar Association, the Mayo Clinic, and the North Carolina Secretary of State, among others. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you'll take a moment to subscribe to the podcast or leave us a review on iTunes. Please also check out our Patreon page, where you can find flexible ways to support Death at Sec while also receiving access to limited access content and swag. We've got a lot more exciting content to share with you. Have a great week, and thanks for listening.